There had been Chinese in Java long before the Dutch, long before the Portuguese. Along with squadrons of coolies hired to perform the hard work, scores of Chinese merchants had sailed down from the southern ports of Fujian province and had set up a prosperous agriculture on the Javan shore. They cultivated sugar and made gallons of the cocoa palm toddies and rice and jaggery arraks that so beguiled and rendered happily insensible generations of visiting Western sailors. Cohen immediately spotted their usefulness. He insisted they stay and become part of his new community, offering them, unlike his fellow Dutchmen, the right to trade privately and to take pepper and bird's nests and sea cucumbers, all of which were readily available in Java, back to their homes across the South China Sea without interference from the monopoly of the company. "They are an uncommonly clever, courteous, industrious and obliging people," wrote one of Cohen's colleagues. "There's nothing you can imagine that they do not undertake and practice. Many keep eating houses or tea houses or earn money fishing or carrying or conveying people." It has been 400 years since those words were written. So far as the impression offered today by the diaspora of overseas Chinese is concerned, very little seems to have changed. Slowly the community was born and struggled to its feet, matured and began to grow. At first, no Javanese were allowed to live within the city walls, and no Javanese were employed as slaves either, lest they band together and conspire against the Dutch. But by the middle of the 17th century, the ban had been relaxed somewhat, and a census in 1673 records the presence within the walls of 27,000 inhabitants, of whom 1,300 were classed as Moors and Javanese. 2,000 of the people were Dutch, nearly 3,000 Chinese, and 5,000 were members of a curious group called the Mardykers, who were Portuguese-speaking Asians, most of them freed slaves from Malacca and India, and who had been converted to Protestant Christianity. The result was that Batavia had a cosmopolitan air of the most exotic stripe. There were turbaned Macassarese and long-haired Ambonese, Chinese with festoons of black queues, Balinese Hindus, black Portuguese vegetable hawkers, Moors from Kerala, Tamils, Burmese, a few soldiers from Japan, and overseeing them all with the haughty disdain that is born of vague fear, the stout and pale-skinned burghers from Holland and Zeeland and Friesland and elsewhere in the flat and cold European north. And then there were the others, now nearly 16,000 of this counted population of 1673, the almost half who were slaves. Their use, which remained legal until abolition in 1860, made life exquisitely comfortable for some. Since no one would risk having slaves from Java, they had to be brought in by ship from elsewhere. An inefficient process, one slave peddler complained, after noting that of a consignment of 250 slaves sent down to him from the Arakan hills of Burma, only 114 had been delivered. And some slaves did flee over the city wall, formed gangs that lived in the jungle and raided parties of wandering Dutch. One, a Balinese named Suopati, had a band of rogues so large and powerful he formed his own fiefdom in East Java, and they ruled it as an independent state for more than a century. The wealthier Europeans in 17th century Batavia might own 100 or more slaves, and the town's main slave market was from the beginning a bustling, crowded place. These Malays and Indians and Burmese and Balinese workers were trained to occupy the tiniest of niches in the household labour structure. Advertisements spoke of a need for lamplighters, coachmen, page boys, tea makers, bakers, seamstresses, and most specialised of all, the makers of a spicy side dish known as sambal. The ladies' maid slaves would be put to work as masseuses or hairdressers, girls who were skilled in fashioning hair in the bun-shaped style known as the conde, and much favoured in the salons of the time. Since they were so plentiful and so cheap, slaves frequently had little to do, and they sat around gambling their days away. But if they ever tried to escape, or worse, if they ran amok — the word is Malay for a state of frenzy and was used as a legal term in the VOC courts — punishment was severe. They could be whipped or imprisoned, and a Dutchman who shot one of his slaves dead and injured three others was merely told to leave Batavia and not to do any further business with the VOC for the rest of his days. Though the townsfolk in those closing years of the 17th century did not know it, their nearby neighbour island of Krakatoa was itself also, and for the first time within their sight, about to run amok. No one had yet noticed that the island in the Sunda Strait had any potential for trouble. None of the navigators who had passed northwards into the Java Sea and who had gazed, as seamen do, at the island with the pointed mountain on their port beam had supposed that one day it might do something quite terrifyingly and world-shatteringly dramatic. They, like the citizens of their destination city, were blissful in their ignorance of the tectonic complications then beginning to unravel many miles beneath their feet. They carried on instead with the serious business of colonial life with a magnificent insouciance that was to be their motif for the next two centuries, right up to the moment of the cataclysm that engulfed their lives when the tiny parrot-filled and palm-covered island finally went mad. But on the eve of its first recorded volcanic throat-clearing, life for the European men and women who lived 83 miles east in Batavia had assumed an atmosphere of a near-settled urbanity. Perhaps the frantic gaiety that would characterise life in the 19th century was not yet apparent. 17th century, eve of eruption life, tended to the more formal, strict, luxurious and at times terrifyingly cruel. The buildings that were being constructed in mid-century were by now quite substantial affairs. The warehouses were massive with teak and mahogany. The grand mansions along the Jacatra Way that were built for the pepper planters and the ship dealers, with their ornate wrought iron gates, their gilded carvings and Delft tiles, moved an otherwise forgotten Mr. Spienhoff to song. At long last I enjoyed myself outside Batavia, along the green heather on the Jacatra Road. And the great town hall was first built during this rather sedate and pompous period, a cupola, shutters, columns and the porte cochere, all part of the standard architecture of the East. This building served a myriad functions. The magistrate's bench was here, licenses were issued, slaves were freed, ships were sold. On the cobbled square outside was a set of stocks, with miscreants frequently seen locked into them. Inside and below ground there were dungeons, and many is the story of how the VOC security officers, who ran their company town with a ferocious rectitude, resorted to torture to extract confessions. A visiting German soldier named Christopher Schweitzer wrote an account of the harshness he saw. The 29th, four seamen were publicly beheaded at Batavia, which is here the common death of criminals for having killed a Chinese. At the same time, six slaves that had murdered their master in the night were broke upon a wheel. A mulatto, as they call those that are betwixt a blackamoor and a white, was hanged for theft. Eight other seamen were whipped for stealing and running away, and were besides this burnt on the shoulder with the arms of the East India Company. Two Dutch soldiers that had absented themselves from the guard 2 days ran the gauntlet. A Dutch schoolmaster's wife that was caught in bed with another man, it being her frequent practice, was put in the pillory and condemned to 12 years imprisonment in the Spinhuis, the woman's prison. Christopher Schweitzer's account is dated 1676. It is suggestive of a certain public unhappiness, of a draconian degree of Dutch response, of a current of distemper in the land. And then, 4 years later, with the situation between rulers and ruled still uneasy, Krakatoa very noisily awakened its slumbering self. It was an event that astonished and perhaps even briefly terrified the new European arrivals. Yet most Javanese, long immersed in a balm of myth and legend relating to their volcanoes, would later say that with all the evident unhappiness abroad, they could have seen it coming. Orang Aliye, the Javan god and mountain ghost whose task is to superintend the emissions of smoke and fire into the eastern heavens, is said to breathe sulphur from his nostrils when all is less than well on his earthly dominions. Krakatoa, which along with Tambora and Merapi and Merbapu and Bromo was one of his most potent mountains, had been blessedly quiet, or comparatively so, for at least the previous 1,200 years. The only event that some might say had taken place to tax his patience was that foreigners, white men from afar, had now come by sea to rule over the people of Java. This, not a few Javan mystics liked to say, was one of the reasons why volcanoes occasionally made their fire, the more forcefully to display the degree of Orang Aliye's grave displeasure. Yet, however displeased Aliye might have been, what followed was by all accounts not the greatest of pyrotechnic performances, and no one who witnessed whatever happened ever came forward to write a first-person account. All we know comes essentially from one man, a Dutch silver assayer from the western Sumatran mining town of Salida, a man named Johan Wilhelm Vogel. Mr. Vogel, who was said to be so pious and studious a servant of the company that he eventually went on to become mayor of Salida, first passed Krakatoa in the usual way en route from Holland to Batavia, thus with the island to his port side, aboard the long-range packet, the Hollandsche Tuin, in June 1679. He waited 10 weeks in town, then left Batavia for Sumatra in September, aboard the yacht Wapen Woutergoos, this time Krakatoa passing by to starboard. He saw nothing that struck him as remarkable. But then, in due course, Vogel fell ill. The company, sedulous in caring for their more valuable employees, ordered him to visit their doctors in Batavia, and he left the Sumatran port of Padang in January 1681 aboard the yacht De Zeyp. This time the Krakatoa he saw presented a very different aspect. He wrote, "I saw with amazement that the island Krakatoa, on my first trip to Sumatra completely green and healthy with trees, lay now completely burned and barren in front of our eyes, and that at four locations was throwing up large chunks of fire. The ship's captain told me this had happened in May 1680. That time also he had made a trip from Bengal, had run into a heavy storm, and about 10 miles away from the island had experienced an earthquake. This was followed by a tremendous thundering crash, which had made him think that an island or otherwise a piece of land had split apart. He and the whole ship's population had smelled a strong and very fresh sulphur odour. Also, the sailors had retrieved with water pails from the sea some very lightweight rocks, very much resembling pumice stone, which had been thrown from the island. They were scooped up as a rarity. He showed me a piece of the island. He showed me a piece of it, a little larger than a fist." By checking the port records of vessels sailing in and out of Batavia, we can see that the captain of the De Zeyp had indeed travelled between Batavia and the port of Bengalen in 1680 aboard the cutter Aardenburg. The story in this respect does thus seem to tally. If it's true, then this long-forgotten and so far anonymous sea captain and his crew were the first Europeans ever either to see the volcano of Krakatoa erupt or to see the results of its recent eruption. The Aardenburg's log, however, has never been found, and the day register of the Batavia Castle, an official journal which records all ship movements in and out of the harbour and any pertinent comments from the vessel's various masters, is silent. A writer named Elias Hesse then wrote a vivid account of an eruption, suggesting that it was continuing in November 1681 when he and Mayor Vogel left together aboard a Sumatra-bound ship called the New Middelburg. He first mentions passing an island called Zibesi, today's Sebesi, a couple of miles north of Krakatoa, and being unable to sleep because the crying of ghosts, which the apparently rather more sober Vogel later reported were orang-utangs, which produce a terrible howling, often when the weather is about to change. He continues, "Then still north of the island Krakatoa, which erupted about a year ago, and is also uninhabited. The rising smoke column of this island can be seen from miles away. We were with our ship very close to shore, and could see the trees sticking out high on the mountain, and which looked completely burned, but we could not see the fire itself." Later, the New Middelburg and its crew of company servants and miners were forced to heave to in the Sunda Strait and experience heavy sea quakes, and learned of an earthquake which, Hesse reported, did considerable damage to the buildings of the company. A close study of the records of other ships passing through the strait at the time, and for a variety of reasons there were very many, shows no other suggestion of an eruption or an earthquake in 1681, and further, the day register has no information, even in May 1680, of anything of interest having occurred in the Sunda Strait. The register reports the more mundane occurrences of city life: a tiger found outside the walls, crocodiles captured in the city streets, a comet seen in the sky, servants running amok. Yet nowhere in 1680 or 1681 is there any mention at all of an eruption on an island that was passed by scores of company ships every week. From this dearth of information, it is perhaps fair to conclude only three things. First, that Elias Hesse was an inventive fantasist, and probably made up his entire account of volcanic activity in November 1681. Secondly, that the silver assayer and sober-sided mayor Johan Vogel was similarly afflicted, and that his suggestion of seeing large chunks of fire at four locations on Krakatoa in February 1681 is also fictional. He did, however, probably see evidence, burned trees, barren plains of ash, that some disaster had befallen Krakatoa a while before. And third, the captain of the De Zuyp and the Aardenburg almost certainly did see something of an eruption in May 1680. But since no other passing vessel did, and since no mention was made of anything grave having occurred to the ever-vigilant bureaucrats in the castle, whatever had happened was small beer indeed, and the captain had, like many men of the sea, made the story into a considerably better one the moment he stepped ashore. Chapter 3. Close Encounters on the Wallis Line. Part 1. Delineation. On a bleak December evening, shortly before Christmas, 1857, in the severely elegant lecture theatre of what was then biology's Sanctum Sanctorum, the Linnaean Society in Burlington House on London's Piccadilly, a young man named Philip Lutley Sclater rose to present a paper which, though all but overlooked by most biologists today, was to lead steadily to a revolution in scientific thinking about the history of the world. Philip Sclater may have been only 28 years old when he stood before the assembled worthies, but already he had won an awesome reputation. He had been to Winchester and Christchurch, Oxford, and was inordinately clever. He was also already unusually well-travelled, to Argentina, Malaysia, India, Australia, and most of the states of America, and was both a superb artist and, the basis of his near-legendary reputation among his few followers today, a brilliant ornithologist. He specialised in the exotic, the colourful, the tropical, the odd. He came to know all there was to know about the South American finch-like birds called tanagers, and the country neighbours of theirs that were called oven birds, since they built their nests out of clay in the shape of ovens. He would write definitive books about passeriforms, that huge class of rather less unusual perching birds. He had a lark named after him, founded the British Ornithologists' Club, and was for many years secretary of the Zoological Society of London. And he gave the name Lemuria to a landmass he believed, wrongly, had in Eocene times connected the Malayan Peninsula with Madagascar, and on the remaining peaks of which now sits the enormous mid-Indian Ocean, British-owned and American-leased military base of Diego Garcia. I might add that Helena Blavatsky, the creator of the genial Hindu-Buddhist religion called Theosophy, also seized upon Lemuria as the likely home for a people that she insisted were the third root of mankind. As she described them, they somewhat lacked classical beauty. They were 15 feet tall, brown-skinned hermaphrodites with four arms, some possessing a third eye in the back of their skull. Their feet had protruding heels, enabling them to walk either forwards or backwards, and their eyes were sighted so that they could see sideways. Crucially, though, for this Krakatoa story, Philip Sclater was also a specialist in a new science that was growing apace during late Victorian times, and which has been called variously either biogeography or zoogeography. As more and more specimens of animals and insects and plants and birds were collected and classified and catalogued, so it became steadily more apparent that geography had a major influence on zoology and botany, that certain living creatures were peculiar to certain parts of the world and not merely to certain climatic zones. One might find precisely the same climate in Uganda and Queensland, for example, but since Africa and Australia were so far away from each other and their native inhabitants had developed without ever making contact with one another, so their flora and fauna were now entirely separate, different and peculiar to each of the two places. The polar populations are another obvious example of zoogeographical reality. Polar bears and people inhabit the north, penguins and albatrosses are peculiar to the south, even though the climatic environment in each place is essentially identical. The birth of the study of such regional differences in populations of plants and animals, of the biota, to use the proper if rather unattractive word, was a natural byproduct of the frenetic pace of exploration of the time. And Dr. Sclater, an explorer of the old school, had by the middle of the 19th century a keenly developed interest and expertise in this topic. The paper that he presented to the Linnaeans that winter's night was on precisely this subject, on the general geographical distribution of the members of the class Arwes, with a particular interest in the islands around New Guinea. And Sclater offered what to his listeners was a remarkable and startling discovery. He had observed what seemed to be a rigid zoogeographical distinction deep within the islands of the East Indies. The kind of dramatic geographical variation that might be seen on two sides of a vast body of water, the measure of difference between African birds and Brazilian birds, for example, separated by the entire South Atlantic, might not be expected within the continuum of an archipelago as closely knit as the East Indies. But here, astonishingly, there was. In months of research that took him right along the 2,000-mile volcanic chain that stretched from Sumatra to the Trobriand Islands, Sclater found the occurrence of a huge and unanticipated and very sudden change. The jungles in the west of the archipelago, for example, sporting birds that were akin to those to be found in India, while those to the east of a vaguely imagined line were alive with an avian fauna that was only to be found in Australia. Sclater had not completed quite enough research to be able to draw a firm demarcation line between the two populations. All he could say for certain was what he had seen. Certain birds, parrots for example, found in wild abundance in the eastern Australian end of the archipelago, were quite literally rarae aves on the western Indian side. There are barely any parrots on Java, but they're every imaginable kind in Sulawesi, Irian and Timor. Not a single cockatoo is to be found in the west. Two entire families each of cockatoos and lories, this last a kind of parrot with a brush-like tongue, are to be found in the east. Barely any thrushes are to be found on any of the islands to the east of Bali. In the western half of the archipelago there are woodpeckers, barbets, trogons, paradise flycatchers and paradise shrikes, minivets, blue drongos, pheasants and jungle fowl, but none of these, just like the humble thrush, is to be found in the east. The forests of this eastern end of the chain, on the other hand, are populated uniquely with legions of showy and exotic birds that one might just as easily find in Queensland and New South Wales, honeysuckers and birds of paradise, cassowaries and emus. Any traveller with half an eye and half an ear open will realise simply from the colours and the birdsong that something profound is going on. In making an eastward journey from Sumatra to Irian, though he may not once pass out of the sight of land, the traveller will have most decidedly left one world and entered another one utterly different. It would be another 40 years before Sclater, working then with his son, would draw a map with a formal delineation, as the pair saw it, that separated the two avian worlds. But his work, which culminated in the reading of his 1857 paper, which outlined but did not quite delineate their meeting place, excited the interest of a much older, bolder, and less well-educated Briton who was then living in the Indies. This was Alfred Russel Wallis, who came swiftly to understand that it was not simply birds who inhabited two quite different worlds. Plants and animals did also, and just like the birds, so they all met, all collided even, somewhere among the maze of jungles of the myriad islands of the Dutch East Indies. Alfred Russel Wallis, who at the time was collecting and studying and living in a grass hut on the spice-rich island of Ternate, would take the observations of this young naturalist and, adding a vast amount of information from his own observations and collections, would transform them into a theory and a grand cartographic creation which exists to this very day and has a name that remains its architect's most familiar memorial, the Wallis Line. Philip Lutley Sclater, learned, patrician and well-connected, might have thought he had some vague right to have this 2,000 miles of tracery named after him, in recognition of his pioneering work on the region's bird geography. But the honour was eventually to be given to his very much more capable successor, the lowly-born, hugely-tall genius from the town of Usk in South Wales, and who's remembered today mainly for having imagined and then drawn this vast and invisible line in the sea. Mainly, but not solely, Alfred Russel Wallis has a trench off Java named after him too, as well as a 13,300-foot peak in the Sierra Nevada, a garden in Wales, an aviary in Bristol, a bird of paradise, biology prizes in both Kansas and Australia, countless lecture theatres and university halls, and craters on both Mars and the Moon. Whoever named a lunar crater in his honour was a man with a mordant wit, or an ear for the laboured pun, for many years Wallis had been known perhaps more widely than anything else as Darwin's Moon, the lesser body that was bound by the fates to dance in constant attendance around the orbit of the greater. For although the Wallis line has yet some importance, and though it has a singular connection to this story of Krakatoa, any account of Wallis himself must make mention of the still greater reasons for such fame as he still has, and that is that Alfred Russel Wallis, alongside Charles Darwin but always as his satellite, is the other true but largely unremembered pioneer of the science of evolution. His birth in Usk in 1823 as the seventh child of a librarian was into a threadbare but intellectually respectable family. He started his own life as a Leicestershire schoolteacher, but one whose life was marked from the start by passionate fascinations, in this first case with the life and times of the Coleoptera, those insects with hard coverings for their flight wings, and which are generally and more prosaically known as beetles. He was also interested in spiritualism, and indeed rediscovered this fascination much later in his life. Mercifully for the advance of science, his dabblings into what he called phreno-mesmerism were suddenly nudged back towards worthier pursuits when he stumbled upon a similarly insect-captivated city lad, a hosier's son and sometime warehouse sweeper named Henry Walter Bates. Russell and Bates, the pair soon inseparable, hunted, collected and catalogued beetles in every corner of Leicestershire and points beyond, with Bates publishing his first paper on coleopterous insects frequenting damp places, the title telling us perhaps more about Leicestershire than about beetles. In 1848, 3 years after meeting and having exhausted the coleopterous delights of the meadows and damp places of the English Midlands, this pair of redoubtable young men combined what little savings they had to begin a remarkable scheme, to go off specimen collecting in the wilds of the beetle-rich, insect-rich Amazon rainforest. For Bates, it was the beginning of a lifelong love affair with what he called the one uniform, lofty, impervious and humid forest, a love affair that started in the remote Brazilian jungle village of Ega, 1,400 miles upriver, with his collection and naming during the 6 years he lived there of no fewer than 550 new and distinct species of butterfly. At the time, only 66 were known throughout the entire British Isles. He travelled thousands of miles in the deepest and most remote corners of the forest, and over the years became a world authority on insect mimicry, and together with his friend Wallis, ultimately came to be an instigator of the theory of natural selection and an unalloyed supporter of Charles Darwin once On the Origin of Species had been published in 1859. For Wallis, however, the journey to Amazonia was just the beginning of a fascination that soon ranged round the entire world, but which is most closely associated today with the region he found the richest and most intellectually satisfying, the then Dutch East Indies. His interest did not properly begin, however, before he had been severely tried and tested on his way home from Brazil. The square rigger Helen, in which he was bringing home his valuable collection of Amazon specimens, caught fire and sank in mid-Atlantic, and Wallis spent 10 days in a longboat before being picked up near Bermuda. He wrote 2 books on his experiences, but Darwin, who trawled through both, looking for evidence to bolster his own fast-coalescing ideas on biological variation and natural selection and species origin, found them frustrating. "Not enough facts," he harrumphed, cruelly unaware that Wallis had lost all of his notes and all of his specimens, all gone down with the foundered ship. In 1854, Wallis set off alone for the East Indies, the chain of islands that he, as a geographer, preferred to call the Malay Archipelago, since the thousands of islands were indeed a classic example of an archipelago, and the island's lingua franca was, in most cases, and to a greater or lesser degree, based on Malay. His keen conviction remained for all the 8 years that he then spent there that evidence to be found in this archipelago would substantiate his 2 growing beliefs, that geography was highly influential in the development of biology, and that species originated by the natural selection of favoured types from within the variations of any population. He spent the better part of his life seeking to prove both points, and by and large, and in the penumbra always of Charles Darwin, he succeeded magnificently. His collecting zeal was prodigious. He sent back to London, or came eventually back with, a meticulously organised collection of no fewer than 125,660 specimens of the plants, animals, insects and birds of the islands. There were 310 mammals, 100 reptiles, 83,000 beetles, not surprisingly, 13,000 other insects, 8,000 birds, 13,000 butterflies and 7,500 shells. His study of this vast number of living things brought him to both of the epiphanies he sought, and almost at the same moment. He suddenly realised evolution's existence and mechanism, and he immediately recognised the profound difference between the two basic animal and plant populations of his chosen archipelago, and he realised and recognised these two profundities at essentially the same time, during what for Wallace were the seminal and intellectually furious years of 1858 and 1859. Wallace's sudden understanding of evolution is one of the most romantic tales of modern science, ranking with the sudden achievements of Archimedes and Galileo, Becquerel and Newton, Fleming and Marie Curie. The vision came to him not in a bathtub, nor in Pisa, nor on a Paddington windowsill or under an English apple tree, but in a grass hut, on stilts, in a village, on the island of Ternate, and during a bout of jungle fever. There are not a few who believe that it should be the Spice Islands, and not the Galapagos, that one day come to be recognised as the true birthplace of the science of evolution. At the time, thousands of miles away in Kent, Charles Darwin was working with painstaking tardiness on what he called his big book. He knew he was onto something. He had the core of an idea as to how and why new species evolved. He had the facts at hand. He collected his own beetles. He had bred pigeons. He had observed and measured and catalogued the tens of thousands of living creatures from his years aboard HMS Beagle. And he was well aware of Alfred Russel Wallace, not least because in 1855 Wallace, then in Sarawak, wrote a paper entitled On the Law Which Has Regulated the Introduction of New Species, and which argued that new species arise from within variations in a population that is somehow, as he was so often seeing in the East Indies, geographically isolated from other populations of the same creatures. The paper presented only an incomplete theory, and it presented no mechanism for this introduction of new species, but it set Charles Darwin once again to pondering, ruminating and, for which he is almost best known, procrastinating. And then, just after New Year's Day in 1858, Wallace arrived in those eastern islands that the Dutch called the Moluccas, or Maluku, as they are once again today. During the intervening 3 years of wanderings between Sumatra and Irian, he had had his full share of excitements. Headhunters had severely scared him on the island of Lombok. His arms and legs had been badly infected by leeches and biting insects. He had found a 10-foot snake in the ceiling of his hut on Ambon, and he suffered from unremitting dysenteric fever and had caught case after case of malaria. Indeed, it was a particularly nasty attack of this, caught when he was on a brief insect-collecting trip to Halmahera, that prompted him to go back to his little house on Ternate at the end of February. He sat and perspired and wrote and pondered and ruminated, and then, in one of those fascinating manic moments of fever-induced excitability, he suddenly got it. While wondering yet again what it might be that caused the break between one species and the success of a specialised variety that would lead to the creation of a wholly new species, there suddenly flashed upon me the idea of the survival of the fittest, that the individuals removed by these checks must be, on the whole, inferior to those that survived. Then, considering the variations continually occurring in every fresh generation of animals or plants, and the changes of climate, of food, of enemies always in progress, the whole method of specific modification became clear to me, and in the 2 hours of my fit I had thought the main points of my theory. Wallace wrote this account in his book, The Wonderful Century, some long while later, which might prompt some suspicions. But any doubts about the legitimacy of his claiming to be the first to recognise both the idea and the mechanism of evolution must be allayed by his having immediately written a paper and dashing off a letter to Down House, asking Darwin to forward it for possible publication to the geologist, Charles Lyell, whom Wallace thought he had better impress. It was Darwin who was impressed. The Wallace paper was, he later said, a bolt from the blue. It deeply disturbed him. It was the very idea for which he was looking. it provided the jolt he needed to get on and finish his big book. And when he did, and the book appeared under the now famous title On the Origin of Species, Wallace's crucial references to the struggle for existence, the survival of the fittest, appear as the keys to the entire mystery. Charles Lyell and Joseph Hooker persuaded Darwin to share at least some of the glory with Wallace, far away, low-born, and an upstart though he may have been. The formal announcement that the puzzle at the root of the science of evolution had now been cracked was made at the meeting of the Linnaean Society on the 1st of July, 1858. It was a joint announcement, made by the introduction of papers by Darwin and Wallace, with Darwin admitting, somewhat lamely, that though he had had the very same idea as Wallace some days before, he had never committed it to paper. Procrastination had done for him. But not, it seems, for his reputation. Darwinism is now the accepted word, having been invented by Wallace and the title of one of his later books. He never displayed in public a scintilla of bitterness, and contentedly and generously gave Darwin all the credit. The classic book, The Malay Archipelago, in which Wallace tried to popularise the idea of a zoogeographical division, and which so neatly coincides with the phenomenon that gives birth to Krakatoa, is dedicated to Darwin to express my deep admiration for his genius and his work. He remained loyal, almost servile, the ever-revolving little moon around Darwin's glittering and far grander planet. He did not receive a knighthood, as had so many of his more nobly born contemporaries, like Galton, Huxley, Lyell, Hooker, and Darwin. He did, however, become a member of the Order of Merit, which many in Britain think more worthy. His public standing then went into a long and slow decline, and outside Indonesia, where he's still well known, he has until lately been little recognised in the world. Perhaps his spell in history's wilderness is now coming to an end. In April 2000, his grave in Dorset was refurbished, and in November 2001, a plaque was unveiled in what is now the Royal Society's Reynolds Room, noting that a century and a half beforehand, the papers of Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace had been read there, and a whole new science of evolutionary studies had been formally set in motion. In recent years, there have been kindly new biographies of Wallace, new studies of his contributions to science, fresh examinations of the papers of Darwin, Lyell, Hooker, and all the others involved in the evolution of evolutionary thinking. There seems, in consequence, a growing sympathy these days for the idea that Darwin may have behaved less than fairly to the man who had the same idea as he had, and at the very same time, but had the misfortune of writing everything down almost immediately and shouting the news from the rooftops, of being less gently born and less well-connected than the master of Down House, and of spending his declining years more interested in eccentric sciences out on the fringes of respectability. To some these days, the idea that Wallace's only memorial is merely a line that passes unseen across the sea seems a melancholy insufficiency for all of his many ideas and achievements. The Wallace line, however invisible, and in later years because of technical arguments among the world's community of zoogeographers, however controversial, does at least have the merit of being directly relevant to the makings and to the violent unmakings of Krakatoa. It may have played only a marginal role in the development of the theory of the evolution of life, but it does play, if unwittingly, a very significant part in the much newer theory of plate tectonics, the evolution of the Earth. Wallace's ideas about his line were first made public at the Linnaean Society on the 3rd of November 1859, 17 months after the famous Society presentation on evolution, and, as then, without his being within 5,000 miles of Burlington House. He was actually in Ambon at the time, just back from a half-year in Sulawesi, spent indulging in what he incautiously regarded as the capital sport of shooting birds of paradise. He was coming under considerable pressure from his family, who hadn't seen him for 5 years, to return home. But he said he felt completely happy and at home in the islands and was not to come back to England until 1862. His observations of the distribution of the archipelago's immense stock of animals reflected precisely Philip Sclater's findings on the distribution of birds, that the representatives of the Australian kingdom of animals lived on the more easterly islands and the members of the Indian families to their west. He was able to show, for example, that in the west there were apes and monkeys. There are none in either Australia nor in the Australian-influenced eastern part of the archipelago. There are flying lemurs, tigers, wolves, civets, mongooses, polecats, otters, bears, deer, cattle, sheep, tapirs, rhinoceros, elephants, squirrels, porcupines and scaly anteaters, none of which are native either to Australia, and it goes without saying not to New Zealand either, which was isolated for so long that it had no native mammals or snakes at all, or to the eastern islands. Out in those eastern groups, though, where the cloves and nutmegs grow in wild profusion, there are all manner of animals that were wonderfully unfamiliar to the newcomer from Usk, including kangaroos, opossums, wombats and the duck-billed platypus. Not an ox nor a squirrel, an elephant or a tapir on any of these islands, but instead animals that raise their young in pouches, or hop, or live half in water and half out, have webbed feet, lay eggs and suckle their young, and flightless birds and cockatoos. Alfred Russel Wallace enjoys such fame as he has because he observed all of this bewildering profusion with great care, noting with exactitude where each animal or bird lived, or just as importantly, did not live, and then drew a long and sinuous line which separated these two very distinct biological regions. The line, which he announced to the Linnaeans in 1859 and refined in a more substantial speech in 1863, wandered in an approximately northeast to southwest direction. It began to the south of Mindanao, the most southerly of the main Philippine islands, and snaked to the north of the oddly shaped island now known as Sulawesi, but which was then called the Celebes. It then swept south through the Strait of Makassar, leaving Borneo on its western, Indian side, and then headed across the Java Sea to the tightest imaginable division, the 15-mile-wide and very deep strait between the islands of Bali and Lombok. The contrast, he wrote, is nowhere so abruptly exhibited as on passing from the island of Bali to that of Lombok, where the two regions are in closest proximity. In Bali we have barbets, fruit thrushes and woodpeckers. On passing over to Lombok, these are seen no more, but we have an abundance of cockatoos, honeysuckers and brush turkeys, which are equally unknown in Bali and every island further west. The strait here is 15 miles wide, so that we may pass in 2 hours from one great division of the earth to another, differing as essentially in their animal life as Europe does from America. If we travel from Java or Borneo to the Celebes or the Moluccas, the difference is still more striking. In the first, the forests abound in monkeys of many kinds, wildcats, deer, civets and otters, and numerous varieties of squirrels are constantly met with. In the latter, none of these occur. But the prehensile-tailed opossum is almost the only terrestrial animal seen, except wild pigs, which are found on all the islands, and deer, which have probably been recently introduced, in Celebes and the Moluccas. What Wallace realised well at the time was that the reason that these two biological regions had so nearly merged and yet had remained so distinct was entirely due to geology. Facts such as these can only be explained by a bold acceptance of vast changes in the surface of the earth, he writes, and goes on to speak of a great Pacific continent which had probably existed at a much earlier period. And he talks vaguely of submergences and breakups of masses of land into islands and other devices which may have caused animals to have existed in isolation and then to have become near but separated neighbours. 4 years later, when he presented a much longer paper on the same topic, Wallace was clearly excited, trembling on the brink of a bold new idea. The nature of the contrast between these two great divisions of the Malay archipelago could best be understood, he might have said to himself, by considering what would take place if any two of the primary divisions of the earth were brought into equally close contact. Africa and South America, for example, differ very greatly in all their animal forms. On the African side, we have baboons, lions, elephants, buffaloes and giraffes. On the other, American side, we have spider monkeys, pumas, tapirs, anteaters and sloths. While among birds, the hornbills, turricos, orioles and honeysuckers of Africa contrast strongly with the toucans, macaws, chatterers and hummingbirds of America. But, he continued to suppose, let us endeavour to imagine that a slow upheaval of the bed of the southern Atlantic takes place, and that earthquake shocks and volcanic activity on the land masses on each side of the ocean cause increased volumes of sediment to be poured down the rivers, such that the two continents gradually spread out by the addition of newly formed lands. The result of these two slow processes, he went on, would be that the Atlantic, which now separates Africa and South America with its thousands of unbridgeable miles of water, might be reduced to an arm of the sea no more than a few hundred miles wide. At the same time, we may suppose islands to be upheaved in mid-channel, and as the subterranean forces varied in intensity and shifted their points of greatest action, these islands would sometimes become connected with the land on one side or other of the strait, and at other times be separated from it. The barrier of the ocean all of a sudden ceases to be a barrier at all. He was floundering here, becoming nervous and stutteringly prolix, knowing only that somehow he was on the verge of something, some explanation, some answer to the question posed by all he had seen. Yes, indeed, some geological process, some series of events that had something inexplicable to do with movement and submergence and upheaval and spreading and uplift and earthquakes and volcanoes, for he was a keen and sometimes very frightened observer of these in his beloved archipelago, had caused this curious avian and zoological division. But as to what? We can almost see Wallace dabbing the perspiration from his brow as he omits to follow through, as his thinking stutters to a halt. He fails to come up with a solution, well aware nonetheless that the answer that he seeks is out there somewhere, but has proven to be too elusive for him this time around. What Wallace was never to realise was that the mechanism that drove all the geology was in due course going to be recognised as the then entirely unimaginable process of plate tectonics. And of what he had not the least inkling was that the tectonic collision that had brought his animals and birds together, which had brought the cockatoo so close to being snared by a squirrel, and the retromingent tapir so near to encountering the web-footed monotreme, more familiarly known as the platypus, was also the self-same collision that brought about Indonesia's reputation as the volcanic cockpit of the world, and with its most notoriously dangerous volcano, Krakatoa, as a classic of the kind. Alfred Russel Wallace knew none of this, but his papers and his discoveries and his still-surviving line prompted others to begin thinking and pondering too, and to start asking why this encounter between the animals and birds of Asia and the animals and birds of Australia might have happened, and much more importantly, since it evidently had happened, just how. The scientific world of the time was in the midst of a terrible ferment, with discoveries and realisations coming at an unseemly rate. To many in the ranks of the conservative and the devout, the new theories of geology and biology were delivering a series of hammer blows to mankind's own self-regard. Geologists in particular seemed to have gone berserk, to have thrown off all sense of proper obeisance to their maker. Men like Hutton, Lyell, and William Smith were fast beginning to suppose that man's existence was, in the grand scheme of the very things that they were delineating, of utter insignificance, his sojourn on the planet temporary and vanishingly brief. Darwin's discoveries, along with those of Wallace, naturally, these very brackets serving to remind us how simple it is still to overlook the dyer's son from Usk, had overturned so much of man's own certainty about his own beginnings. And now, thanks to Wallace's other discoveries here in the Celebes and Borneo, in Lombok and Bali, the certainties about the very immobile and unyielding solidity of the world itself were being challenged. Such a series of hammer blows! Mankind, it seemed, was now suddenly really rather, dare one say it, insignificant. He may not, after all, have been, as he had eternally supposed, specially created. The book of Genesis, believed by so many as the Holy Writ it came to be called, was perhaps no more than the stuff of myth and ancient legend. And now even the continents themselves, long supposed to be the most reliable and unshifting bedrock of our very existence, had become mobile. The earth's surface, said this new breed of seers and iconoclasts, was shifting and unstable. The world was not rock solid at all. Such musings among the scientists were seen variously as dangerous, unsettling, ungodly, and evil, and small wonder after so many centuries when man was comforted by the certainties of simpler beliefs. It was a bold man indeed who would now pose further questions about such matters head on. one man who did take the great risk of placing his ponderings on paper, and who came up with what to many was a highly unwelcome answer, and so suffered mightily as a result, was the German Alfred Lothar Wegener. Part 2. Disputation. Alfred Wegener was an Arctic explorer, a meteorologist, pipe-smoking, taciturn, tenacious, once described simply as the quiet man with a charming smile. But the theory he advanced in a book published in 1915 made certain that he became famous, though for the heresy for which he was famed, he was vilified and most cruelly denied his deserved academic reward. And when he died at the very early age of 50, he was a figure of notoriety and ridicule. Only in the last few decades has the wheel come full circle, and has Alfred Wegener come to be regarded as one of the most prescient figures of 20th century science. The problem that led to Wegener's personal trials was the very virtue that gave him the insight. He was a generalist, interested in everything, content to step outside the perimeters of his chosen science, meteorology, and to dabble in the wide variety of other unrelated sciences that fascinated him. Scientific specialists, who still today guard jealously their own fields of research, attacked him roundly for daring to invade their territories, and never more so than in 1915, when he first published in German his now famous book, The Origin of the Continents and the Oceans. In it, he used a phrase that was to make him especially notorious, Die Verschiebung der Kontinent, which translates literally as continental displacement, but which by 1926, when it made its first recorded entry into the English language, had transmogrified into what is today's more familiar phrase, continental drift. Wegener's roving attention had first been attracted by the simple Mercator map of the world. He noticed, in a cursory glance that bred a sudden revelation, something that seems perfectly obvious today. He wrote a hurried note to his fiancée. The coastlines of Africa and South America are such, with the huge eastward convexity of Brazil, so alluringly similar to the immense eastward concavity between Nigeria and Angola, that they seem to fit. Might it not be, Wegener wondered, that once, in some incalculable past, the two continents had actually been joined together? And further, might it not be possible that since they had been joined and no longer were, that they had in subsequent years slipped, shifted, nay, drifted apart? Others had noticed the congruency of Africa and South America too. Indeed, they would have been blind not to. The difference was that only Wegener, a trained planetary astronomer then working as a weather forecaster, had the temerity to take the notion and look further. He still had his work to do. He went on a series of expeditions to Greenland, an island so wonderfully complicated and instructive that it appears all too often in the stories of geology and geologists. He flew in balloons to check upper atmosphere jet streams. He sent dozens of high-flying kites to study the polar weather phenomena. But though the climate and the atmosphere fascinated him, the idea that the continents below might somehow have moved was fast becoming an obsession. He looked for support for the idea. He examined carefully the observations of other scientists and at the conclusions of their fields. He looked at geology, at paleontology, at paleoclimatology, and, most importantly for this story, at Sclater and Wallace's newfangled zoogeography and biogeography. He wanted to see if there was any hard evidence to back his idea that the continents had somehow moved from their initial positions to where they were now. And he found plenty, some of it hard and convincing, some of it circumstantial and tempting, much of it vague and alluring. The easier evidence comprised those existing mountain ranges and coal deposits and fossil appearances that were to be found on the far sides of the oceans, right across from the obvious fits, when maps of the continents were pushed together to fit properly. Then the ranges and the outcrops of exploitable minerals, and the lines of ammonites and trilobites and skeins of graptolitic shales themselves also slotted together perfectly, like pieces of a gigantic jigsawed puzzle. To deal with drifting continents where there was no obvious visible fit, instances of which were much more numerous, Wegener found it simpler to work backwards. He would draw maps of the world's surface as he surmised that it might once have been, and then looked to see if there was geological, climatic or biological evidence of possible fits that would then back him up. He created charts based on notions put about by earlier theorists that there had once been a great southern continent, Gondwanaland, first named by Edward Seuss in 1885, and an equally great northern continent, Laurasia, and that the pair had been separated by a great sea, the Tethian Ocean. According to early theorists, the Tethys had originated by way of continental sinking, an ever-popular explanation for all manner of earthly mysteries, and which of course remained the basis for such enduring myths as the vanishing of Atlantis. Wegener plotted onto images of these supercontinents and superseas the fossil evidence of a number of well-known and easily identifiable past events, like the great Permo-Carboniferous Ice Age. Amazingly, the fossil trails, which were so broken and discontinuous and almost randomly scattered across the continents today, joined up when the continents were theoretically pushed together and huddled around what looked like what was once the world's 300-million-year-old South Pole. It all began to look very compelling, with more than enough evidence of later fossilised events to allow Wegener to follow the tracks that the chunks of continental crust must have taken across the surface of the globe to their present positions. Gondwanaland, for example, could be seen breaking up into the massive bodies that in due course would become Africa, Antarctica, South America and Australia, with the peninsulas of India and Arabia floating off into their own separate existences from within it. Wegener was able to plot how the fragments moved, when they moved, where they ended up at different times in the geological past. Laurasia had exploded too, fragmenting into wandering lumps that had the vague appearance of North America, Greenland, Europe, and that part of Asia that today lies north of the Himalayan mountains. Wegener was able also to suggest the paths of their various intercontinental excursions and nudge them into their present shapes and dispositions. The more that this modest, tweedy weatherman thought and theorised, the more it seemed probable to him that the two early continents of Laurasia and Gondwanaland had themselves, in fact, been one. This single continent came to be called Pangaea, though Wegener, who was credited with its invention, never actually used the word. The very Nordic term Pangaea appears in a later edition of his book, though it's not at all clear that he coined this either. The first use of the word comes in a 1924 translation of Wegener's book by a man named Skirl. Pangaea had then broken apart in some giant mitosis. The Tethian Sea had swept in between the two superfragments that resulted, and then many tens of millions of years later, these smaller bodies had broken up as well and had eventually given us the world that we know and recognise today. One day, a man visited me whose fine features and penetrating blue-grey eyes I was unable to forget, the great German geologist Hans Kluss later recalled of his meeting with Wegener. He spun out an extremely strange train of thought about the structure of the earth and asked me whether I'd be willing to help him with geological facts and concepts. Such was the beginning of Wegener's attempts to get his idea accepted. It was a battle he fought long and ultimately in vain. The world was simply not ready to accept that its surface moved with such immense drama. Hans Kluss, who was himself to become a grandee of fundamental geology, with papers on the physics of faulting and the deep-seated deformations of granites, was kindly and sympathetic, though he was never entirely convinced. Wegener's theory, he wrote, placed an easily comprehensible, tremendously exciting structure of ideas upon a solid foundation. It released the continents from the Earth's core and transformed them into icebergs of gneiss on a sea of basalt. It let them float and drift, break apart and converge. Where they broke away, cracks, rifts, trenches remain. Where they collided, ranges of folded mountains appear. It was tempting to believe it, but it was not a temptation to which Kluss, thus far inhabiting a comprehensively proofless world, was quite prepared to yield. The rest of the academic community was implacably hostile, almost to a man. "Utter damned rot," said the president of the American Philosophical Society. "If we are to believe this hypothesis, we must forget everything we learned in the last 70 years and start all over again," remarked Thomas Chamberlain, a towering figure in American geology, on hearing Wegener speak in New York in 1923. Anyone who valued his reputation for scientific sanity said a British geologist at the same time, when Wegener's ideas were being given wide airing, would never dare support such a theory. Harold Jeffreys, a giant among early geophysicists, denounced Wegener with indignation and scorn. However powerful the forces that might be brought to bear beneath the Earth's crust, none could be sufficiently strong to move it. And what of all the suggestive evidence of the permo-carboniferous ice age cluster neatly arranged around Gondwanaland's south pole, perhaps the strongest piece of evidence that Alfred Wegener had? Mere geo-poetry, they said, the stuff of little more than idle fantasy. And so Wegener was pushed out into the cold, like a querulous customer in a barroom of rowdies. Not a single German university would give him the professorships that his otherwise impeccable pedigree deserved. It was left to the University of Graz in Austria to offer him only the chair in meteorology. He was obliged to stand away from the geology that was the business of others. Alfred Wegener died young, quite convinced that he was right, but with the world beyond equally convinced that he was wrong. His ideas, it was almost universally agreed, were the results of bad science at best, wishful thinking at worst. He died in his beloved Greenland, contentedly engaged with the problems of what the weather was doing above the earth, rather than worrying over the complex strangulations of what might have happened below. He had helped set up an observation camp 250 miles inland, high up on the ice cap, to study yet again the Byzantine wonder of the polar climate. He was said by his companions at the time to be deeply happy, blissfully unworried by the firestorm he had ignited among the academic community back to the south. It was shortly after his 50th birthday, on the 1st of November 1930, that he and his faithful Greenlander companion, Rasmus Willemsen, had set off to return to the west coast. It was very cold, recorded temperatures of minus 58 degrees Fahrenheit, and dark. The only blessing was that the howling gales were, at least when they left the ice camp, at their backs. But neither man was ever seen alive again. The following May, an expedition was sent out and found Wegener's body, fully dressed, lying on a reindeer skin in a sleeping bag. His blue eyes were still open, and he seemed, the expedition report noted, to be smiling. It appeared that he had died of a heart attack. His companion had seemingly pressed on for the sea, but had perished in the attempt. His body was never found. The men who found him erected a 20-foot iron cross above the nameless spot on the glacier where he died. Sometime in the 1950s, when another dog team passed by, the cross had vanished. The glacier ice had moved on and had torn itself to pieces and had taken Wegener's body with it. It would be stretching a point to suggest that the ice moved in quite the way the Earth did. Indeed, the mechanism for the Earth's postulated crustal movement was one of the factors that Wegener did not understand and could not fully imagine, and his inability to do so was one reason his sceptical foes were so active and effective. But in Greenland the ice moved, and yes, whether it was provable now or sometime in the future, the Earth's crust surely moved too. One can almost hear Wegener, calm and pipe-smoking to the end, insisting to those around him who would not believe, and using the very words that Galileo Galilei had used to the churchmen who had made him recant nearly three centuries before, Eppur si muove. You may force me to say what you wish, you may revile me for saying what I do, but it moves. And as with Galileo, so with Alfred Wegener. Apart from the barest murmurs of dissent from groups of present-day fundamentalists, creation scientists, and flat-earthers, the entire scientific world now happily acknowledges that Wegener, whom all once thought a crank, was in essence and in fact quite right. Moreover, in the peculiar context of this story, it turns out that the very processes that Wegener first and so bravely suggested happened to underlie, both literally and figuratively, the making and unmaking of all volcanoes, the formidably spectacular eruption of Krakatoa among them, everywhere on the planet. Part 3. Divination. Yet it was not anywhere near a volcano, and certainly not in the steamy heat of Java or Sumatra, where Wegener's theories first came to be properly confirmed. In the 1960s, hard scientific evidence decisively proving the occurrence of continental drift flooded in from a great many sources, some of the most compelling being found fully 10,000 miles and two entire hemispheres away from Krakatoa, and 80 years after the catastrophe that happened there. and Wegener would have savoured this particular irony of geography, since it was early exploration work in the high Arctic snowfields of East Greenland where some of his ideas were first fully tested and shown to be sound. And as it happened, and by a series of strange coincidences that I was not to appreciate fully until the day many years later when I stood watching the sound and light show from Anak, Krakatoa, I played a part, a very lowly part but an unforgettable one, in one of the Greenland expeditions where some of those first confirmations of continental drift was gathered in. I was lucky. I happened to be in just the right place at what science has now shown was just the right time. It was the summer of 1965, and I was a 21-year-old geology student at Oxford. And though I didn't recognise any special significance to it then, much of the unravelling of the most profound enigma of the world's volcanoes, why do some parts of the world erupt while the rest do not, started at the very same moment that I happened to win a place on a small expedition to a wild and unknown part of the East Greenland coast. While I was packing my steel crampons, shark-skin skis, and moleskin salopettes for the journey north, I had not the vaguest thought in my head that this trip might have anything to do with a tropical mountain of which I barely knew and which lay half a world away. From the moment I had first spotted the Greenland announcement, thumb-tacked onto a department notice board between offers of second-hand mineralogy textbooks and of a former student's barely used Estwing hammer and his Brunton compass, I was entranced by the thought of a summer in the cold of the far, far north. I positively yearned to go. High latitudes had long exerted a strange compulsion. As a child, I had been raised, quite conventionally for a Briton of my generation, on the heroic imperial stories of Scott and Shackleton, and, less conventionally, on the tall tales of the even more heroic foreign figures, like Fridtjof Nansen and Peter Freuchen. Much later, and thanks to the peculiar Arctic interests of my Everest-climbing Oxford professor, a tiny but physically and intellectually powerful man named Lawrence Wager, two of the most renowned of Greenland wanderers, Knud Rasmussen and Gino Watkins, had become the greatest of my heroes too. Suddenly, the chance of being able to take off to spend some time in their Arctic, in the wastes where they had made their names, seemed to be the most noble and romantic of ideas. Since I had no obvious qualifications for making the team, I decided to teach myself a vaguely appropriate skill that might make me of some potential use. Morse code seemed as good a choice as any, and so I spent a fortnight learning it, and became in short order reasonably competent and fast, and put the word around Oxford that I might in consequence have some value to offer. The ploy evidently worked. Shortly before the expedition was due to set off, and just as I had hoped and schemed, the leader called me in for an interview, and on hearing of my professed ability to tell a dot from a dash, he had me tap out the highly rhythmic code for the word essences on his desktop, which goes dit 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 da dit da dit da dit 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 dit. He signed me up. I was to go along as sled hauler, since I was reasonably fit and strong, and I was required to add to my duties that of radio operator. Only out on the ice cap did I discover that the team's radio was, in fact, set up for voice transmissions alone. There was no Morse key, even to allow me to show off. As the purest of adventures and the dream of every schoolboy everywhere, what happened that glorious high Arctic summer still remains paramount. Despite my having subsequently lived a life of fairly unremitting world wandering, that two-month expedition to the Blossville coast, south of the great high Arctic fjord system, the world's biggest, known as Scoresby Sund, has never once been matched. The memories of those 50 days stay with me yet. It started with embarkation in Copenhagen, the piles of expedition boxes among the coils of rope and crates of fish, the cold smell of the northern sea and the sweet sharp aroma of Stockholm tar. It got properly underway a few days later, at the moment when, from the icebreaker's chilly bridge wing, we first picked out the luminous glow of the ice blink on the north horizon of the Denmark Strait, and our little red ship began bucking and cracking her hull through the thick and wind-scoured pack ice. From then on, higher and higher above the Arctic Circle, every subsequent moment, every experience became vivid, intense, unforgettable. We landed on a remote beach on the iron-bound coast of the immense, mysterious island. We climbed, in brilliant sunshine, the ice wall, and then the crevassed length of a fast-moving, mile-wide glacier. We spent weeks camping high on the ice cap. We rappelled down sheer walls of black basalt. We skied for scores of miles over snow where none had ever been before. We learned to speak the Danish-Inuit linguistic blend called Greenlandic, in which the country is called Kalalit Nunat, our land, in which a snowflake is Kanik, snow flurries Nitalak Niluitkatatuk, and a good 47 other words besides that speak of snow or ice and their many varieties. We grew beards, we grew strong, we became bronzed by the perpetual midnight sun. And when the season was ending and the dark and the cold crept in, so we would thaw our boots out each morning over the primus stove and watch as our hot washing water, when tossed into the air, fell back as a mist of perfect snowflakes. There were problems, naturally. We ran out of supplies, except for low-temperature margarine, of which we had a good quarter of a ton. And so I, no great shot at the best of times, but the caretaker of the expedition's only rifle, had to shoot a polar bear for food. It was an aged bear, not at all tasty, and its limbs were riddled with planaria, flatworm parasites that we had to tease from between its thigh muscles. The following day, and entirely by chance, I followed the shooting of the bear by bringing down a goose in flight with another single shot. From today's perspective, all horribly incorrect things to do, except that we were keenly hungry and there was nothing else to eat. We then found ourselves socked in by bad weather, were delayed by 2 weeks, and our Danish icebreaker had perforce to leave for Copenhagen without us. We had to risk walking for an endless day, 60-pound boxes of precious rock samples on our backs, over a crazed sea carpet of thin and fast-shifting ice floes, in order to reach an Eskimo settlement and relative safety. We still needed food. We hunted muskox with the local men and then dined with them on young seals, their bellies opened up and filled with roasted seabirds, to which we added from our near-depleted stores, and as the most unfamiliar of condiments, bay leaves. And we barely got home. The season was changing. The sun was setting earlier and earlier each afternoon. Storms were blowing in from the north. The brave Icelandic pilot who came and collected us in a blizzard in the near dark was killed the very next day, flying his Cessna into a cliff in that mythically ghastly part of North Iceland called the Claw. When we heard the news, we'd been celebrating, eating cream cakes in the Savoy in London. We slunk away to our various homes in an awful, sombre silence. But however memorable Greenland was as an experience, it was as science that our little expedition had its greatest value.